It's Friday, September 23rd. These documents are eyes only, but there are suddenly a lot more eyes. We start here. After being overruled by a panel of judges, a federal court allows prosecutors to review what they found at Mar-a-Lago.
Trump has provided no evidence in court that these documents were declassified.
So how will this affect the case involving former President Trump? Russia starts summoning soldiers, at least the ones still in the country.
We heard people chanting, "Send Putin to the trenches."
What a mass exodus says about Russian resolve in Ukraine. And if employees did this, they'd be fired.
He remarked to her, "Why do all you women here cry so much?"
So why did it take a player backlash for an NBA owner to step down? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. At this point, you know that one of the biggest stories of the summer was federal agents showing up at the residence of a former president to execute an unprecedented search warrant, right? Like, if you haven't heard about that yet, you should really Google that. That was pretty big. Well, in the days since that, the biggest questions have revolved around what classified documents former President Trump had and whether he could be prosecuted for holding on to them after his presidency ended. Any court case, of course, would rely on prosecutors actually being able to see those documents, which recently a judge said they couldn't. Not all of them, not without the approval of a special master presiding over them.
Judge Aileen Cannon citing the interest in ensuring the integrity of an orderly process amidst swirling allegations of bias and media leaks.
Some legal analysts said this ruling was bizarre, even unlawful. Well, then this week, a federal appeals court overruled this judge.
The court noted DOJ was likely to succeed in showing the judge abused her discretion in reference to those classified documents.
And yesterday, federal prosecutors once again got the ability to press forward towards, well, what exactly? That's what we're going to start the day off by asking. ABC's Catherine Falders has been tracking all the ins and outs of this search. So, Catherine, can you just explain what's happened in the last day or so?
Okay, so let's back up here, Brad. A couple days ago, an appeals court, a three-panel court here, two Trump appointees and one Obama appointee, they gave the Justice Department access to these classified documents again. This was after, you've heard a lot about her, Judge Aileen Cannon, also a Trump appointee, essentially halted DOJ's investigation, DOJ's criminal investigation into the documents that were found at Mar-a-Lago.
The Justice Department said Trump lost access to the hundreds of classified documents when he left office, adding government records were likely concealed by the Trump team.
Obviously, DOJ appealed that full order, but they also asked the appeals court for a stay, essentially to halt the judge's ruling so their investigation can move forward. And look, that's what they got here.
The court noted that Trump has submitted no official record that he actually declassified the documents.
The 11th Circuit agreed with DOJ. They said Trump has provided no evidence in court that these documents were declassified, for example. But the court also said, why does this argument even matter in the first place, right? The main question is, why were these government documents down at Mar-a-Lago? And even if they were declassified, for example, then he hasn't demonstrated a need to have the information in the first place.
Yeah, I've been wanting to ask someone about the process of declassification.
If you're the president of the United States, you can declassify just by saying it's declassified, even by thinking about it, because you're sending it to Mar-a-Lago or to wherever you're sending it. And there doesn't have to be a process. There can be a process, but there doesn't have to be. You're the president. You make that decision.
President Trump went on Fox this week and basically said, yeah, if you declassify these documents, which I did, then it's not illegal to have the documents. Then they're just papers and there's nothing secret about them.
I guess if that system worked, then any president could reclassify the documents, right? Just by thinking about them. Look, that's not how the declassification process works. Many legal experts have told us that a president can't just wave a magic wand. And while there might not be any, let's just say, formal process as it relates to a president declassifying, they still have to go through the proper channels here, Brad, whether it's communication with the DOJ, with the FBI, there still has to be some form of paper trail that says these documents are declassified. And Trump's lawyers, or Trump, neither of them have provided any evidence in terms of a paper trail saying or proving that they're declassified.
So, okay, at this moment, Catherine, who has access to what right now? Like, who is allowed to see what documents?
I know. This is a great question, and it's entirely confusing on many levels. But right now, DOJ investigators have gotten access back to those classified documents that they didn't want to turn over to the special master. They didn't want to give to Trump's team. But now the investigators in the criminal probe have access to them again after it being halted for about a week or so.
But wait, so then, Catherine, if the prosecutors can see whatever they want again, why does the special, like, who needs a special master? Like, why does the dude still have a job then?
Well, because, look, he's not going to get these classified documents, but there were still thousands of documents, government documents, taken from Mar-a-Lago on August 8th, and Trump's team still wants him to go through those documents and deem what he believes can be used as evidence as this case moves forward. But look, he's having a real impact here, even though he's not going to get these classified documents.
The special master told Trump's attorneys today that they need to provide detailed lists of every single document deemed covered by some kind of privilege.
He's essentially laying out this vigorous scheduling order. He wants answers, for example, to whether Trump's lawyers dispute anything that was on that detailed property inventory of items taken from Mar-a-Lago. He wants details on what documents they believe are covered by any form of privilege. And he also wants a summary explaining their decision on each one of these individual documents. And all of this is important because the special master is essentially making them say this on the record in court.
Yeah, there's been a lot said here by President Trump so far that his lawyers have actually not found worthy of arguing in front of a judge yet. Catherine Falders, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, Vladimir Putin is drafting more Russian recruits. Now he's just got to find them. That's after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been about 48 hours since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced he needed to mobilize 300,000 Russian reservists to continue his assault on Ukraine. Well, within 24 hours, so many people were trying to get out of the country, worried they'd be called up, that some border crossings were effectively shut down. But in the last 24 hours, these mobilizations are officially underway. Let's go to ABC's Patrick Reeval, who has spent basically the last few years hopping between Moscow and Ukraine and London, where we find him now. Patrick, what does it look like when Vladimir Putin tells you you have to come do your duty and go to the front? What are you seeing?
Hi, Brad. So the first full day of Vladimir Putin's mobilization has been underway, and it's the first time that Russia has seen a mobilization since World War II. Well, it means that we've been seeing recruitment officers going around in some places from village to village, handing out draft notices. We've seen these sort of tearful farewells. Mustering stations all over the country. And we've also seen, in some places, flashes of anger. We've seen confrontations. I mean, and nowhere really have we seen enthusiasm for it. I think everywhere we see people going reluctantly. They don't want to go, but in many cases they feel they have no choice. Some perhaps because they feel that this is, they're answering a call up for, from their motherland. But I think in many, many cases, it's much more the case that if you don't go, then you face criminal charges. And so we've seen out in one place down in southern Dagestan, we saw a video come out where there was this extraordinary exchange where you had a recruitment officer in this shouting match with men who'd been mobilized. And she was screaming that it was their duty to go. And they were yelling back that, you know, their grandfathers might have fought in World War II, but that was for the motherland. This is just about politics.
This changes everything. Putin is asking a lot of the individual Russian person.
Think as soon as this announcement came through, we saw this massive spike in tickets being bought out of Russia. It's actually already very difficult to get out of Russia because of the sanctions, because so many airlines have stopped flying. And so people headed basically for the border, many of them in their cars. So we see down near Georgia, for example, in the neighboring country of Georgia, we see huge lines, 10-kilometer queues and lines of traffic of people desperately trying to get out. I mean, the reason is that people don't know if they're going to be able to get out. People are also reporting that when they get to the border, sometimes the FSB agents there are telling them they can't leave, even though they're not actually formally subject to this call-up.
Yeah, who is getting called up? Like, who, is it just everyone, every man or woman over the age of 18? Like, what is the demographic here?
So this is kind of key. Putin, in his announcement, claimed that this was a partial mobilization. He said that it would only affect reservists and those with military experience. And so he painted it as very limited, even though he also, then his defense minister said it would be 300,000 people, which is obviously still a huge number of people. But they were still kind of trying to paint it as limited and not affecting everyone. But in reality, when we saw the actual presidential decree come out that ordered the mobilization, we see that there isn't actually any sign of any limits on it, really. There isn't any sign that it is a partial mobilization. And in fact, what many people fear is that what this will allow the Kremlin to do is in reality take anyone they want, as many people as they want. They'll try and stop it spiraling out of control into huge anger. After this announcement was made, after the mobilization was announced, there was a call put out for nationwide protests, and people did come out in relatively small numbers still. It was probably in Moscow no more than a couple of thousand, really, at most. And they went to Moscow's central street, and there it was a very familiar scene that we have seen many, many times in Russia. Riot police basically grabbing people almost at random, some places very roughly. I remember in Moscow, we saw people having their faces shoved into walls. In St. Petersburg, it was the same. We saw small crowds, people just standing. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, we heard people chanting, "Send Putin to the trenches." The fact that people have come out at all certainly shows the strength of feeling. I think what will be more interesting in some ways now is to see what happens as people actually are called up and see if we see more of these angry scenes, more of these confrontations where people are asking, why am I being brought up?
Well, and Patrick, like, as we see these reactions, these probably understandable reactions of people being like, I'm not going over there. Like, no, thank you. But as someone who has spent time with so many people in Moscow and elsewhere in Russia, could this become like Vladimir Putin's Vietnam, right, where everyone seems on board as it starts over there, but then when it becomes about your son or your daughter going to a war zone, all of a sudden nobody's on board?
I mean, this is the huge question. And I think for a very long time, we know that the Kremlin did not want to take this step because they understand that it is a huge risk and that it takes it out of their hands and becomes very unpredictable. And so for a long time, they've basically been pretending that Russia isn't at war. I mean, in Moscow, people were going about their lives, and the policy, the actual policy from the Kremlin, was to make people think that everything was fine. And now they've turned around and said, actually, we need 300,000 men at a minimum to keep this going. And so, yes, it's a huge risk for the Kremlin. And now no one knows where this is going. All we know is that right now, Putin has decided to cross another Rubicon and is just plunging deeper and deeper into this and pulling his own country after him deeper and deeper into these very, very risky waters.
Yeah, some of this footage, just the raw emotions coming from potential soldiers and their family members, wild to watch. Patrick Riewel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
There are not a ton of companies in the U.S. worth over $1 billion. One of them is the Phoenix Suns, you know, the NBA basketball team.
Here come the Phoenix Suns, for the first time in 28 years, are going back to the NBA Finals.
Well, last year, our partners at ESPN published a story in which employees alleged that the owner of this $1.8 billion franchise was often engaging in what amounted to sexual harassment and sometimes tossing around racial slurs, which unfortunately is something we've heard before. Rich white male billionaire accused of creating a hostile work environment. But in a sign of shifting power dynamics in the NBA, league officials commissioned an investigation, and upon hearing the results, players loudly demanded this owner sell the team. They got their wish in less than a week. Baxter Holmes is a senior writer at ESPN where he covers the NBA. In fact, he was the one that broke this story last November. And Baxter, let's start with that. Can you just walk us through the initial allegations?
Yeah, so I, over a period of many months, talked to 70 current and former employees over the 17-year tenure of Robert Sarver as the team's majority owner. And they outlined a litany of allegations of essentially workplace misconduct, principally tied to him, but not solely tied to him. There were also senior leaders there who staffers believed were complicit in workplace misconduct as well. One story that I will probably always remember was an account where Robert was said to be berating this female employee. She began to break down, and he remarked to her, "Why do all you women here cry so much?" That was just one of many accounts that people shared of inappropriate language, which in the NBA's eventual report, they would describe as bullying, specifically towards women, but not only towards women. And then
the allegations are of racism, hostile work environment with racism.
Earl Watson, then a head coach, in an encounter with Robert, who was saying essentially that this NBA player uses the N-word, how come I can't? Mm. And Earl, who is black, was telling him, you cannot use that word. And they went back and forth. And Robert, in according to Earl, used it repeatedly. A whole range of issues. It was quite a long story. And on the day that it was published, the NBA announced that they were going to be launching an investigation. The law firm Wachtell Lipton, which the league has used twice before in investigating NBA owners, was commissioned to lead the investigation, and it took them 10 months, interviewed more than 300 people, went through 80,000 text messages, a slew of internal documents, and just this last week, they announced their findings, which amounted to a one-year suspension of Sarver, a $10 million fine. He was also asked to complete what amounted to essentially sensitivity, workplace conduct training. But then things really started to heat up from there.
Yeah, and denials all over the place from the Suns, right? They immediately came out and said, they almost preempted you, saying you're about to read like an untrue story from ESPN. Sarver has said emphatically he never used that word. He recalls the situation, he says, and he did not, in fact, say that word. The team says that there has never been any sort of misogyny or sexism at the workplace. And yet, there were all these denials ahead of time saying your story wouldn't be true. This investigative group basically found, yes, it was true. At least that was their initial finding in this report. What has happened now in just the last week?
Yeah, it's been a dizzying turn of events. So you have the NBA announcing what their findings were in this very detailed report. The following day, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, gave a press conference.
I was in disbelief to a certain extent about what I learned.
He appeared quite uncomfortable having to describe why the penalty was not more severe. Remember, Adam Silver works for the owners, and he said during his press conference, the owners, in short, he kind of said the quiet part out loud, the owners have different rights than maybe somebody who works for a team.
I understand. I, of course, have been following what's been said since we issued, those findings. You know, let me reiterate, the conduct is indefensible. But I feel we dealt with it in a fair manner.
He also categorized this as saying many of these things happened a long time ago. I know employees in Phoenix were very upset at that particular line. But then, soon after, just hours after Adam's remarks, LeBron James and Chris Paul both came out on Twitter and said the NBA got it wrong. Hmm. Their penalties were not severe enough.
Quote, read through the Sarver stories a few times now. I got to be honest, our league definitely got this wrong. I don't need to explain why.
Soon after that, you have PayPal, a major sponsor of the team.
Sponsors, they're beginning to separate themselves from the Phoenix Suns in the wake of the NBA's investigation.
Saying that they were not going to renew their sponsorship if Robert Sarver remained the owner. You have the head of the players' union, same week, saying that the, and speaking on behalf of the players, calling for Robert to be banned for life.
We do not want him to be in a position where he is managing or engaging with individuals who are engaging with our players or our players themselves.
You had Draymond Green, Golden State Warriors star, saying that the owners need to have a vote, need to hold a vote to terminate Robert as owner, and
putting the onus on the other owner because they can vote out a guy. So like, this is on you. This is not just up to him.
Yeah. He was, you know, because people had been saying, well, you know, it's on the players to kind of do something. But in reality, and Draymond, this is a very tactical move on his part. He was saying, no. You guys have the power. A 3/4 vote of the owners can terminate an owner. And he noted this point, which I thought was critical. He said, this vote, we will see who is with us and who is against us, who has morals, who believes in equality, who believes in diversity.
Like, all right, so let's have the vote. Because then also what we'll know is who else may be standing behind closed doors.
So the succession of these events, I can't stress this enough, really turned up the temperature.
Developing story into SportsCenter, Robert Sarver, the owner of the Phoenix Mercury and the Suns, has begun the process of selling the teams, he said in a statement. Sarver was suspended.
So when he announced that he was going to sell the team and the Phoenix Mercury, which he also owns, it sent shockwaves through the NBA. It sent shockwaves through the Phoenix Suns organization. There were many people there that considered all along that Robert would never relent, that he would never back down, that he would never give in. Look, let's be honest. The team is going to sell for excess of $2 billion, perhaps even $3 billion. Robert, who owns about a third of the team, is going to do very well in the end, no matter what.
I was going to say, selling the team, you still get paid for the thing.
There is no shortage of buyers for this team. It is in a very attractive, warm weather market. It's close to LA. It's close to Las Vegas. It's a place where players want to play. There are very deep-pocketed individuals who have been circling this organization in the potential reality that it could come up for sale. This is a hot item.
Yeah, and that fact in itself seems to kind of point to what it sounded like so many players were frustrated about and what these employees were frustrated about, that essentially what Adam Silver said, that owners have a different set of consequences for these sorts of moments in their careers. There was that feeling that might be true, considering he is about to walk out with a ton of money from this sale out of a league that has prided itself on its relationship with its majority black players, even though we've now had multiple owners accused of outright racism. Baxter Holmes from ESPN. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, on any given day, NASA is tracking 30,000 asteroids. Well, now we're finally ready to take one out. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. Remember the movie Armageddon? Huge meteor is heading towards Earth. The only chance we've got is to blow it up.
I'll never do that again.
Well, tell Ben Affleck we don't need his services. Real NASA scientists are now on the case. So here's my first question, Gina. Is this plan any different from the plot of Armageddon?
Very different, because no one will die.
That's ABC's Gina Sanseri, fresh out of a NASA briefing in Houston, as officials described their plan to save the Earth from an asteroid.
Hitting an asteroid is a tough thing to do.
Well, a hypothetical asteroid. Nothing out there is targeting us now. But on Monday, we get a test run.
It's DART. It's for, you know, double asteroid redirect.
I did not know this until yesterday, but at this moment, there was a spaceship about million miles away, aimed straight for this pair of asteroids. On Monday night at 7:14 p.m. Eastern, it will ram into one of them at 15,000 miles an hour.
And then impact. We'll say loss of signal and we'll celebrate.
The idea is just to bump it off course, which raises the obvious question, why wouldn't you just do what they do in Armageddon and blow the thing out of the sky?
You don't want to blow up an asteroid because what does that do? It creates more space junk.
Gina says the plan is not to make a bunch of tiny asteroids, it's to just nudge this one a little off course. At a far distance, just a tiny deviation would make a meteor miss us. The key, though, is to know about these things way ahead of time when they're still out there.
Every 100 years, we know there's a big, bad asteroid that comes for us. We had one just a few years ago that hit in Russia, remember? And so we don't know of one right now, but scientists are always hunting for that one. And what this one will give us is the information if we see one that's got us in its sights, that we can launch a spacecraft early enough to change it and keep it from whacking planet Earth.
In the meantime, she says, these twin asteroids will have the attention of every major telescope on Earth Monday, along with all the astronomers who don't want to miss a thing. If you were wondering, I made Gina make sure of this. Yes, the people at NASA say they are aware of the movie Armageddon. They have all watched it. No, they will not be sending up guys from an oil rig to drill the meteor. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Madeline Wood, Vika Aronson, Iru Ekpenobi, Cameron Chertavian, and Tara Gimbel. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of podcast programming. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is the head of ABC Audio. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, and our intern, Nia McLean. Special thanks this week to John Santucci, Stephanie Ebbs, Frankie Perez, Chris Howell, Kevin Ryder, Katie Dendas, Zoe McGee, and the whole London team that covered Queen Elizabeth's funeral, and Michelle Franzen, of course, who did a great job filling in this week. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.